I'm Gordon Comstock. This is the Ministry of Truth. This is part two, just wrapping it up, of part two of Will the Real Government Please Stand Up by James Montgomery. We're into the footnotes now, but the footnotes have some incredible history that you've never been told before. One of the highlight of it is the veto message by President Johnson, March 2nd, 1867. When he tried to veto the 14th Amendment, which was really a totalitarian takeover by a rump Congress in the North. It was a coup d'etat, and we're living under it now. We have the 14th Amendment, and it dictates that we, the average American, cannot question the national debt anymore. We're slaves. We're brickmakers. That's when they iced it. Actually, there was another little nail driven into the coffin in 1933 when the American citizens were legally declared enemies of the state. But the Reconstruction Acts were horrific. And President Andrew Johnson gets smirched in history, and now you know the reason. It's because he actually stood up to the bankers, actually tried to do his job. He was apparently a decent man. His veto speech was full of passion, and he was pleading with these northern bought-off northern senators, pleading with them not to do this, to rip to shreds the 1787 treaty with Britain that was the Constitution, the corporate charter. But they went ahead and did it, of course. Now, President Johnson does not, you can't go so far as to say he was heroic, or he would have taken it to the people. He would have taken it to the streets vociferously if he was a hero, but, you know, politicians are still ultimately politicians. He would have been assassinated, of course, just like Lincoln had he tried that, but he was at least a decent man. And he did try to stand up to them in his veto message. Let's hear from this. Veto message by President Johnson, March 2nd, 1867. I have examined the bill to provide for the more efficient government of the so-called rebel states. I'm just going to read the highlights that I've highlighted with my marker. I am unable to give it my assent for reasons so grave that I hope a statement of them may have some influence on the minds of the patriotic and enlightened men with whom the decision must ultimately rest. The bill places all the people of the 10 states therein, named under the absolute domination of military rules, and the preamble undertakes to give the reason upon which the measure is based and the ground upon which it is justified. It declares that there exists in those states no legal governments and no adequate protection for life and property, and asserts the necessity of enforcing peace and good order within their limits. This is not true as a matter of fact. The states in question, capital S, have each of them an actual government with all the powers, executive, judicial, and legislative, which properly belong to a free state. They are organized like the other states of the Union, capital S, and like them they make, administer, and execute the laws which concern their domestic affairs. An existing de facto government exercising such functions as these is itself the law of the state upon all matters within its jurisdiction. To pronounce the supreme law-making power of an established state illegal is to say that law itself is unlawful. The provisions which these governments have made for the preservation of order, the suppression of crime, and the redress of private injuries are in substance and principle the same as those prevailing in the northern states and in other civilized countries. Skipping down, the bill, however, would seem to show upon its face, this is the 14th Amendment bill, that the establishment of peace and good order is not its real object. Skipping down. Sixth, the adoption of a certain amendment to the federal constitution. Skipping. Seventh, the adoption of said amendment by a sufficient number of other states to make it a part of the Constitution of the United States. All these conditions must be fulfilled before the people of any of these states can be relieved from the bondage of military domination. Skipping. The excuse given for the bill in the preamble. Skipping. But solely as a means of coercing the people into the adoption of principles and measures to which it is known that they are opposed, and upon which they have an undeniable right to exercise their own judgment. I submit to Congress whether this measure is not, in its whole character, scope, and object, without precedent and without authority, in palpable conflict with the plainest provisions of liberty and humanity for which our ancestors on both sides of the Atlantic have shed so much blood and expended so much treasure. The 10 states named in the bill are divided into 5 districts, for each district an officer of the army, not below the rank of a brigadier general, is to be appointed to rule over the people, and he is to be supported with an efficient military force to enable him to perform his duties and enforce his authority. Those duties and that authority, as defined by the 3rd section of the bill, are to protect all persons in their rights of person or property, to suppress insurrection, disorder, and violence, and to punish or cause to be punished all disturbers of the public peace or criminals. The power thus given to commanding officer over all the people of each district is that of an absolute monarch. His mere will is to take the place of all law. It is plain that the authority here given to the military officer amounts to absolute despotism. But to make it still more unendurable, the bill provides that it may be delegated to as many subordinates as he chooses to appoint. For it declares that he shall punish or cause to be punished. Such a power has not been wielded by any monarch in England for more than 500 years. In all that time, no people who speak the English language have borne such servitude. It reduces the whole population of the 10 states, all persons of every color, sex, and condition, and every stranger within their limits, to the most abject and degrading slavery. No master ever had a control so absolute over the slaves as this bill gives to the military officers, over both white and colored persons. So much for the so-called Civil War being fought over slavery, huh? Skipping down. Have we the power to establish and carry into execution a measure like this? I answer, certainly not. Skipping down. Some persons assume that the success of our arms in crushing the opposition, which was made in some of the states, reduced those states and all their people, the innocent as well as the guilty, to the condition of vassalage. Skipping. No fallacy can be more transparent than this. Our victories subjected the insurgents to legal obedience, not to the yoke of an arbitrary despotism. When an absolute sovereign reduces his rebellious subjects, he may deal with them according to his pleasure, because he had that power before. But when a limited monarch puts down an insurrection, he must still govern according to law. This is a bill passed by Congress in time of peace. There is not in any one of the states brought under its operation either war or insurrection. The laws of the states and of the federal government are all in undisturbed and harmonious operation. Skipping. What, then, is the ground on which this bill proceeds? The title of the bill announces that it is intended for the more efficient government of these 10 states. It is recited by way of preamble that no legal state governments nor adequate protection for life or property exist in those states. and that peace and good order should be thus recitals, which prepare the way for martial law. Is this that the only foundation upon which martial law can exist under our form of government is not stated or so much as pretended? Actual war, foreign invasion, domestic insurrection, none of these appear, and none of these in fact exist. It is not even recited that any sort of war or insurrection is threatened. Skipping. A recent decision of the Supreme Court of the United States, skipping, the opinion of the majority of the court, martial law cannot arise from a threatened invasion. The necessity must be actual and present, the invasion real, such as effectually closes the courts and deposes the civil administration. We see that martial law come in only when actual war closes the courts and deposes the civil authority. But this bill, in time of peace, makes martial law operate as though we were in actual war, and becomes the cause instead of the consequences of the abrogation of civil authority. One more quotation. It follows from what has been said on this subject that there are occasions when martial law can be properly applied. If in foreign invasion or civil war, the courts are actually closed and it is impossible to administer criminal justice according to law, then on the theater of active military operations where war really prevails, there is a necessity to furnish a substitute for the civil authority thus overthrown to preserve the safety of the army and society. And as no power is left by the military, it is allowed to govern by martial rule until the laws can have their free course. My gosh, both the executive and the judiciary apparently tried to stop this rump Congress. Apparently they didn't try hard enough, though, you know. Continuing with Andrew Johnson's words, I now quote from the opinion of the minority of the court, delivered by Chief Justice Chase, we by no means assert that Congress can establish and apply the laws of war where no war has been declared or exists. Where peace exists, the laws of peace must prevail. Skipping. Peace exists in all the territory to which this bill applies. It asserts a power in Congress in time of peace to set aside the laws of peace and substitute the laws of war. The minority, concurring with the majority, declares that Congress does not possess that power. Skipping forward. This bill authorizes an arrest without warrant at pleasure of a military commander. This bill holds every person, not a soldier, answerable for all crimes and all charges without any presentiment. This bill sets aside all process of law and makes the citizen answerable in his person and property to the will of one man, and as to his life, to the will of two. This bill declares martial law in time of peace and authorizes the military to make the arrest and gives to the prisoner only one privilege, and that is trial without unnecessary delay, whatever that is, right? He has no hope of release from custody, except the hope, such as it is, of release by acquittal before a military commission. You know, this is kind of creepy, because aren't we, post-9/11, aren't we getting back to this military tribunal thing? It's just Reconstruction. Folks, it's been here ever since. They just haven't had to dredge it out since the Reconstruction. But it's always been a power that they've taken upon themselves since the Reconstruction, and they can always bring it back. Looks like they're bringing it back. Getting back to Andrew Johnson's decrying of this bill. The United States are bound to guarantee to each state a republican form of government. Can it be pretended that this obligation is not palpably broken if we carry out a measure like this? which wipes away every vestige of Republican government in 10 states and puts the life, property, and honor of all people in each of them under domination of a single person clothed with unlimited authority. Here is a bill of attainder against 9 million people at once. It is based upon an accusation so vague as to be scarcely intelligible and found to be true upon no credible evidence. Not one of the 9 million was heard in his own defense. The representatives of the doomed parties were excluded from all participation in the trial. The conviction is to be followed by the most ignominious punishment ever inflicted on large masses of men. It disenfranchises them by hundreds of thousands and degrades them all, even those who are admitted to be guiltless, from the rank of free man to the condition of slaves. The purpose and object of the bill, the general intent which pervades it from beginning to end, is to change the entire structure and character of the state governments and to compel them by force to the adoption of organic laws and regulations which they are unwilling to accept if left to themselves. The Negroes have not asked for the privilege of voting. The vast majority of them have no idea what it means. This bill not only thrusts it into their hands, but compels them, as well as the whites, to use it in a particular way. Skipping. Neither blacks nor whites can be relieved from the slavery which the bill imposes upon them. Skipping. The federal government has no jurisdiction, authority, or power to regulate such subjects for any state. Skipping forward. That the measure proposed by this bill does violate the Constitution in the particulars mentioned, and in many other ways which I forbear to enumerate, is too clear to admit the least doubt. It only remains to consider whether the injunctions of that instrument ought to be obeyed or not. Skipping forward. Shall we now acknowledge that we sacrificed 1 million lives and expended billions of treasure to enforce a constitution which is not worthy of respect and preservation? Boy, that was well said. It is a part of our public history which can never be forgotten that both houses of Congress in July 1861 declared in the form of a sole man resolution that the war was and should be carried on for no purpose of subjugation, but solely to enforce the constitutional rights of the states and of individuals unimpaired. This resolution was adopted and sent forth to the world unanimously by the Senate and with only 2 dissenting voices in the House. It was accepted by the Friends of the Union in the South as well as in the North, as expressing honestly and truly the object of the war. So in other words, the Northern senators flat out lied about their object in pursuing the so-called Civil War. It was all about conquest for them, for the bankers, of course, their bosses. But here in 1861, they declared that it was not about that. So they perjured themselves. That, well, they weren't under oath. Well, were they? I don't know. Anyway, they lied. On the faith of it, many thousands of persons in both sections gave their lives and their fortunes to the cause. To repudiate it now by refusing to the states and to the individuals within them the rights which the Constitution and laws of the Union would secure to them, and the rights Montgomery has in quotes here, is a breach of our plighted honor for which I can imagine no excuse, and to which I cannot voluntarily become a party. Skipping forward. Among the most sacred guarantees of that instrument are those which declare that each state shall have at least 1 representative, and that no state, without its consent, shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Skipping forward. not only hurting the life of the present generation, but for ages to come, skipping, the destiny of themselves and their children. At present, 10 states are denied representation. And when 16 states will be without a voice in the House of Representatives, skipping, this grave fact, a course of legislation which fails to consider the rights it transgresses, the law which it violates, or the institutions which it imperils. Wow. Andrew Johnson was on fire in this speech. He really, at least within the walls of Congress, within the White House, he really pleaded with these people, don't do this. But the rump Congress of the North overrode him. You just, when I read this, I wish that Andrew Johnson would have just taken it to the streets if he was that upset, which he should have been, apparently. At any rate, that's what Andrew Johnson had to say at the time the Reconstruction Acts were railroaded through Congress by a conquering rump Congress. Okay, there are, I want to read some highlights from footnote 11 that Montgomery has in here. This apparently is a letter from James Montgomery to his local sheriff in North Carolina. This I think you'll find this interesting. And I won't read it all, just highlights here. Starts it out, dear sheriff, I just want to say at the outset that your reputation precedes you, blah, blah, blah. Then he gets into the meat a few sentences down. The Constitution was a commercial compact between states, giving the federal government limited powers. The Bill of Rights was not meant as a source of rights, but as further limitations on the federal government. Our forefathers saw the potential for danger in the U.S. Constitution. To ensure the Constitution was not presumed to be our source of rights, the 10th Amendment was added. I will use a quote from Thomas Jefferson from February 15, 1791, where Thomas Jefferson quotes the 10th Amendment. Quote, I consider the foundation of the Constitution as laid on this ground, that all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states or to the people, and that's a lowercase p in people, to, unquote. Oh, no, this is still Jefferson. He's got another quote in here. Continuing with Jefferson's quote, to take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power no longer susceptible of any definition, unquote. Now we pick it up again with Montgomery talking to the sheriff. Three forms of law were granted to the Constitution, common law, equity or contract law, and admiralty law. Each had their own jurisdiction and purpose. The first issue I want to cover is the United States flag. Obviously, from known history, our flag did not have a yellow fringe bordering three sides. The United States did not start putting flags with a yellow fringe on them in government buildings and public buildings until the 1900s. Why did it change? Are there any legal meanings behind it? Oh, yes. First, the appearance of our flag is defined in Title 4, Section 1, United States Code. And it just has, it describes the flag, and it says, well, I'll read it, part of it. A footnote, a placing of fringe on the national flag, the dimensions of the flag, an arrangement of the stars are matters of detail not controlled by statute but within the discretion of the President as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy. The President, as military commander, this is Montgomery now, can add a yellow fringe to our flag. When would this be done? During a time of war. Why? Because a flag with a fringe is an ensign, a military flag. And then another quote here, pursuant to U.S. Code, Chapter 123, Executive Order Number 10834, August 21st, 1959, a military flag is a flag that resembles the regular flag of the United States, except that it has a yellow fringe bordered on three sides. The President of the United States designates this deviation from the regular flag by executive order, and in his capacity as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. This quote is from the National Encyclopedia, Volume 4, and just a couple of highlights from this. From a military standpoint, flags are of two general classes. And it says the military kind has a, with a knotted fringe of yellow on three sides, is a military flag. Back to Montgomery. The reason I started with the flag issue is because it is so easy to grasp. The main problem I have with the yellow fringe is that by its use, our constitutional republic is no more. Our system of law was changed without the public's knowledge. It was kept secret. This is fraud. The American people were allowed to believe this was just a decoration. Because the law changed from common law, or God's law, to admiralty law, or king's law, your status also changed from sovereign to subject. From being able to own property, allodial title, to not owning property, tenant of the land. If you think you own your property, stop paying taxes. It will be taken under the prize law. This is a quote from Senate Document Number 43. The ultimate ownership of all property is in the state. Individual so-called ownership is only by virtue of government, i.e. law, amounting to a mere user. That's Senate Document Number 43, written in 1933, when Americans were declared enemies of the state by lovely FDR. Back to Montgomery's words. By our allowing to let these military flags fly, the American people have admitted our defeat and loss of status. Remember, the Constitution recognizes three forms of law. Being governed by the law of the flag is admiralty law, law of the flag. And this comes from Bouvier's Law Dictionary, 1914. Law of the flag at the masthead, is notice to all the world of the extent of such power to bind the owners or freighters by his act. The foreigner who deals with this agent has notice of that law, and if he be bound by it, there is not injustice. His notice is the national flag which is hoisted. Back to Montgomery. Don't be thrown by the fact they are talking about the sea. Admiralty has come onto land. And this quote comes from Roostrat versus People, whatever year this happened. Quote, pursuant to the law of the flag, a military flag does result in jurisdictional implication when flown. Back to Montgomery's words. When you walk into a court and see this flag, you are put on notice that you are in an admiralty court and the king is in control. Also, if there is a king, the people are no longer sovereign. Skipping forward. Admiralty law is for the sea. Maritime law governs contracts between parties that trade over the sea. Well, that's what our forefathers intended. However, in 1845, Congress passed an act saying admiralty law could come onto land. The bill may be traced in Congress. 28th Congress, 2nd Session, 43, the year 1844, 1845, no opposition to the act is reported. Congress held a committee on this subject in 1850, and they said, quote, "The committee also alluded to the great force of the great constitutional question as to the power of Congress to extend maritime jurisdiction beyond the ground occupied by it at the adoption of the Constitution," unquote. Back to Montgomery. "It was up to the Supreme Court to stop Congress at that moment and tell them, no, the Constitution did not give you that power, nor was it intended. But no, the courts began a long train of abuses. Here are some excerpts from a few court cases. Quote, "This power is as extensive upon land as upon water. The Constitution makes no distinction in that respect. And if the Admiralty jurisdiction in matters of contract and tort, which the courts of the United States may lawfully exercise on the high seas, can be extended to the lakes upon the power to regulate commerce, it can, with the same propriety and upon the same construction, be extended to contracts and torts on land when the commerce is between different states," capital S. "And it may embrace also the vehicles and persons engaged in carrying it on. It would be in the power of Congress to confer admiralty jurisdiction upon its courts over the cars engaged in transporting passengers or merchandise from one state to another," capital S, "and over the persons engaged in conducting them, and deny to the parties the trial by jury. Now the judicial power in cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction has never been supposed to extend to contracts made on land and to be executed on land. But if the power of regulating commerce can be made the foundation of jurisdiction in its courts, and a new and extended admiralty jurisdiction beyond its heretofore known and admitted limits may be created on water under that authority, the same reason would justify the same exercise of power on land," unquote. That from 1851, from Propeller Genesee Chief et al. Versus Fitzhugh et al. Next court case is from Jackson versus Magnolia in 1852. Quote, "Next to revenue taxes itself, the late extensions of the jurisdiction of the Admiralty are our greatest grievance." Listen up, folks. This is the origin of Admiralty law on land in this country. 1852. "The American courts of admiralty seem to be forming by degrees into a system that is to overturn our Constitution and to deprive us of our best inheritance, the laws of the land. It would be thought in England a dangerous innovation if the trial of any matter on land was given to the admiralty," unquote. Jackson versus Magnolia, 1852. Back to Montgomery. "This began the most dangerous precedent of all the insular cases. This is where Congress took a boundless field of power. When legislating for the states, they are bound by the Constitution. When legislating for their insular possessions, they are not restricted in any way by the Constitution." The following is from the Harvard Law Review, "Our New Possessions." Congress apparently created... Okay, these courts, then, are not constitutional courts. They are legislative courts, created in virtue of that clause which enables Congress to make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory belonging to the United States, capital S. There you see, Congress created its own court system outside the Constitution, according to the Harvard Law Review. Here are some court cases that make it even clearer, this crooked dual court system when it was established. This is from 1945, a court case, Hooven and Allison and Company versus Evett. Quote, In exercising this power, Congress is not subject to the same constitutional limitations as when it is legislating for the United States. And it cites insular possessions. Skipping. Oh, no, this is a different court case now. This is 1901, Downs versus Bidwell. Quote, "We have in this country substantially or practically two national governments, one to be maintained under the Constitution with all its restrictions, the other to be maintained by Congress outside and independently of that instrument by exercising such powers as other nations of the earth are accustomed to exercise. If the principle thus announced should ever receive the sanction of a majority of this court, a radical and mischievous change in our system of government will be the result. We will, in that event, pass from the era of constitutional liberty, guarded and protected by a written constitution, into an era of legislative absolutism." There you go. "It will be an evil day for the American liberty if the theory of a government outside of the supreme law of the land finds lodgment in our constitutional jurisprudence." Unquote. Downs versus Bidwell, 1901. Back to the words of James Montgomery. "These actions allowed admiralty law to come onto land." Remember the definition of the law of the flag. "When you receive benefits or enter into contracts with the king, you come under his law, which is admiralty law." Now we're getting into the adhesion contracts, which bind us all, just about all of us now, and render us slavish brickmakers for Pharaoh. Well, your 501c3 pastor says on Sunday, what a free country this is. All right, so going back to Montgomery. "And what is a result of your connection with the king? A loss of your sovereign status. Our ignorance of the law is no excuse. I'll give you an example, something you deal with every day. Let's say you give me a seatbelt ticket. What law did I violate? Remember, the Constitution recognizes three forms of law. Was it common law? Who is the injured party? No one. So it could not have been common law. Was it equity law? No, there is no contract in dispute. Driving is a privilege granted by the king. If it were a contract, the UCC would apply, and it doesn't. In a contract, both parties have equal rights. In a privilege, you do as you are told, or the privilege is revoked. Well, guess what? There is only one form of law left, admiralty. Ask yourself, when did licenses begin to be required? In the year is 1933. All district courts are admiralty courts. See the Judiciary Act of 1789. The following quote is from the 1847 court case Waring versus Clark and Howard. Quote, "District courts, acting as instance courts of admiralty, the Act of 1789 gives the entire constitutional power to determine all civil causes of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, leaving the courts to ascertain its limits." Unquote. Back to James Montgomery's words. "When you enter a courtroom and come before the judge and the U.S. flag with the yellow fringe is flying, you are put on notice of the law you are in. Americans aren't aware of this, so they continue to claim constitutional rights. In the admiralty setting, the Constitution does not apply, and the judge, if pushed, will inform you of this by placing you under contempt for continuing to bring it up. If the judge is pressed, his name for this hidden law is statutory law. Where are the rules and regulations for statutory law kept? They don't exist. If statutory law existed, there would be rules and regulations governing its procedures and court rules. They do not exist. The way you know this is admiralty is from the yellow-fringed flag and from the actions of the law, i.e. compelled performance, which is admiralty. The judges can still move at common law for cases like murder, etc., and equity for contract disputes, etc. It's all up to the type of case brought before the court. The court and rules of all three jurisdictions have been blended. Under admiralty, you are compelled to perform under the agreement you made by asking and receiving the king's government, i.e. license. You receive the benefit of driving on federal roads, which are military roads. So you have voluntarily obligated yourself to this system of law, and this is why you are compelled to obey. If you don't, it will cost you money or jail time or both. The type of offense determines the jurisdiction you come under. But the court itself is an admiralty court defined by the flag. Driving without a seatbelt under Chapter 20 DMV Code carries a criminal penalty for a non-common law offense. Again, where is the injured party or parties? There is none. This is admiralty law, the roads being military. Skipping forward, a military road through the territories of the United States. Skipping forward, the government, ever since its origin, has been in the constant practice of constructing military roads. That is actually a quote from President James Buchanan, 1857, in his inaugural address. Back to James Montgomery. The Social Security Act, the nexus agreement you have with the king. You were told the Social Security number was for retirement, and you had to have it to work. Sounds like a license to me, and it is. It is a license granted by the President to work in this country under the Trading with the Enemy Act, as amended on March 9, 1933. What does FICA stand for? Federal Insurance Contribution Act. What does contribution mean at law? Not the Webster's Dictionary. This is where they were able to get you to admit that you were jointly responsible for the national debt, and you declared that you were a 14th Amendment citizen. Skipping forward, read the following definition to learn what it means to have a Social Security number and pay a contribution. Definition of a contribution from Black's Law Dictionary, 6th edition. Contribution, quote, the right of one who has discharged a common liability to recover of another also liable. Under principle of contribution, a tortfeasor against whom a judgment is rendered. You get the idea. Contribution means you were enslaved. All right, skipping to James Montgomery's next paragraph here. Guess what? It gets worse. What does this date, 1933, mean to you? Well, you better sit down, Sheriff. First, remember World War I? In 1917, President Wilson declared the War Powers Act of October 6, 1917, the War Powers Act basically stating that he was stopping all trade with the enemy except for those he granted a license for, excluding Americans. Read the following from this Trading with the Enemy Act, where he defines enemy. In the War Powers Act of 1917, Chapter 106, Section 2C, it says that these declared war powers did not affect citizens of the United States. Here, wow, Woodrow Wilson will admit in legalese that the U.S. is at war with its own citizenry, is the note I made. Let me see. Skipping, this is Woodrow Wilson's quote. Subjects of any nation with which the United States is at war, other than citizens of the United States. Did he just declare that the U.S. citizens are subjects? He declared that. And he declared that the United States, meaning the corporation, is at war with citizens of the United States. That is legalese par excellence, is it not? Oh, boy. Getting back to Montgomery. Now, this leads up to 1933. Our country was recovering from a depression and now was declared bankrupt. And skipping down. Before 1933, all contracts with the government were payable in gold. Skipping. To keep from being hung by the American public, I guess he means hanged, they obeyed the banksters' demands and turned over our country to them. They never came out and said we were, talking about the politicians, I guess, they never came out and said we were in bankruptcy, but the fact remains we were and are. In 1933, the gold of the whole country had to be turned in to the banksters, and all government contracts in gold were canceled. This is bankruptcy. And then here we have a quote from Congressman Traficant from 1993. Mr. Speaker, we are here now in Chapter 11. Members of Congress are official trustees presiding over the greatest reorganization of any bankrupt entity in world history, the U.S. government. And Congressman Traficant was thrown in jail shortly subsequent to saying that on the House floor in 1993. Forward, Montgomery now. The wealth of the nation, including our land, was turned over to the banksters. In return, the nation's $100 billion debt was forgiven. The Congress of 1933 sold every American into slavery to protect their own asses. Skipping forward. What did Roosevelt do? He sealed our fate and our children's fate. But worst of all, he declared war on the American people. Remember the War Powers Act, the Trading with the Enemy Act during Wilson's regime. He declared emergency powers, FDR declared emergency powers with his authority being the War Powers Act, the Trading with the Enemies Act. The problem is, he redefined who the enemy was. Read the following. Yeah, and remember what he said about the Social Security number being a license to work, huh? Quote, the declared national emergency of March 9th, 1933 amended the War Powers Act to include the American people as enemies. Section 2, Subdivision D, it's all here if you want to read this for yourself. But I'm just reading the content. I'm not going to read the numbers and the pages. Quote, emergency declared by the President may, through any agency that he may designate or otherwise, investigate, regulate, or prohibit under such rules and regulations as he may prescribe, by means of licenses or otherwise, any transactions in foreign exchange, transfers of credit between, or payments by banking institutions as defined by the President, and export, hoarding, melting, or earmarking of gold or silver coin or bullion or currency, now get this, by any person within the United States or any place subject to the jurisdiction thereof. He just declared war on Americans. Here is the legal phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. At law, this refers to an alien enemy and also applies to 14th Amendment citizens. And he gives this Valentine's Law Dictionary. He confirms that. Skipping forward. The following. are excerpts from the Senate Report, 93rd Congress, November 19th, 1973, Special Committee on the Termination of the National Emergency United States Senate. This is from 73. They are going to terminate all emergency powers, but they found out they did not have the power to do this, so guess which one stayed in? The Emergency Act of 1933, the Trading with the Enemy Act, October 6, 1917, as amended in 1933. This is from the Senate Report, 93rd Congress, November 19, 1973, quote, "Since March 9, 1933, the United States has been in a state of declared national emergency. Under the powers delegated by these statutes, the President may seize property, organize and control the means of production, seize commodities, assign military forces abroad, institute martial law." They can do that whenever, folks. It's all lawful for them, legal for them now. "Seize and control all transportation and communication, regulate the operation of private enterprise, restrict travel, and in a plethora of particular ways, control the lives of all American citizens. A majority of the people of the United States have lived all their lives under emergency rule. For 40 years, freedoms and governmental procedures guaranteed by the Constitution have, in varying degrees, been abridged by laws brought into force by states of national emergency from at least the Civil War, in important ways shaped the present phenomenon of a permanent state of national emergency." And Montgomery just cites various law dictionaries showing how alien enemy is an one who owes allegiance to the adverse belligerent. So, citizens, American citizens, you are alien enemies. You are adverse belligerents. Skipping to Montgomery's next footnote, footnote 12, some highlights. This is interesting. This is from the court case Diet versus Turner. Doesn't say the year, but it gets into a little more specifics about the senator from New Jersey who originally voted in favor of the 14th Amendment, but then rescinded his vote when he saw what they were doing criminally against the southern states. He said, "I want no part of this," and so they threw this New Jersey northern senator out. This is good. It tells you his name and some of the details behind it. All of the 22 senators and 58 representatives from the southern states were denied seats. Joint resolution number 48 proposing the 14th Amendment. A count of noses showed that only 33 senators were favorable to the measure. And 33 was a far cry from two-thirds of 72 and lacked one of being two-thirds of the 50-seated senators. While it requires only a majority of votes to refuse a seat to a senator, it requires a two-thirds majority to unseat a member once he is seated. See Article 1, Section 5, Constitution. 1. John P. Stockton was seated on December 5, 1865, as one of the senators from New Jersey. He was outspoken in his opposition to joint resolution number 48, proposing the 14th Amendment. The leadership in the Senate, not having control of two-thirds of the seated senators, voted to refuse to seat Mr. Stockton upon the ground that he had received only a plurality and not a majority of the votes of the New Jersey legislature. It was the law of New Jersey and several other states that a plurality vote was sufficient for election. Besides, the senator had already been seated. Nevertheless, his seat was refused, and the 33 favorable votes thus became the required two-thirds of the 49 members of the Senate. In the House of Representatives, it would require 122 votes to be two-thirds of the 182 members seated. Only 120 voted for the proposed amendment, but because there were 30 abstentions, It was declared to have been passed by a two-thirds vote of the House. They called the abstentions yes votes. What a coup d'etat. This is interesting. A little addendum is footnote 13 that James Montgomery puts in here. He says he just discovered the following two end notes, and they completely confirm in a very final way his research in British Colony Parts 1 and 2 and 3. Okay, let's get into this. I'll read the highlights. Quote, it doesn't say where this is from. I'll just read it. The two main issues, as I see them, in British Colony are... This is Montgomery's writing. I don't know why he put quotes in them. Anyway, the two main issues, as I see them, in British Colony are... One, the financial obligations of the 1213 Charter are still in effect. 1213. Along with the charters establishing America. Two, the last sentence of the 1689 Bill of Rights proved the following. That the charters of the colonies could never be overturned by a Declaration of Independence. You hear that, constitutionalists? The charters of the colonies could never be overturned by a Declaration of Independence or the 1787 treaty called the Constitution. I'm talking about the real subject matter, which is financial obligation. We got that saying we always throw around, follow the money, it's all about the money. But we don't put that to use and remember that statement when we're talking about our own government and our own origins. It's all about the money. You can't get away from that. Follow the money. They're not going to let us declare independence, and let us off from financial obligation. Think about it for a second. Britain had the biggest navy at the time. They could have blockaded the colonies and starved them out at any moment. Washington won a battle at Yorktown. They did not win the war. And it probably was a Masonic deal. Again, some of those battles were fought by the British with one hand behind their back. There's Cornwallis. He led it. He fought it very perfunctorily. He threw balls and had dances with posh ladies in the colonies instead of pursuing the battles. Come on. And then the thing that's really phony to me, the French fleet coming just in time at Yorktown to defeat the British. Can you name one other single instance in history where the French Navy defeated the British? Never happened. Never, never, never happened. And you're telling me you believe, though, that one instance? Come on. It reeks of secret handshake, backdoor room, lawyerly, Freemasonic deals. Okay, back to Montgomery. Title for the land was transferred to the states and then ceded by charter to the federal government under cestui quae trust. But the contracted debt and obligation of the colonial charters and the 1213 Charter could not be negated. Rights could be granted to the citizens, subjects, or combatants, whichever the case may be, but financial obligation cannot, nor could not be affected because it involves parties not yet born. This is why King Charles I said the 1689 Bill of Rights would not free the kingdom from the obligation of the 1213 Charter. This is why the United States Bank was given the right of charter in America. George Washington had no choice but to succumb to the Rothschilds' point man, Hamilton. Talk about deja vu. I mean, does this not sound familiar? Our Bill of Rights was given to us to give us the illusion of freedom. When the tax obligation of the charters marched along unimpeded and unseen by Americans and Britons alike. Read the Magna Carta again. They wanted the Pope's blessing for the 1215 Charter, This same Pope is the Pope in the 1213 charter, where England and Ireland were given to him. He could not just give back his land because of other parties not yet born. The Pope let the barons presume they were free and gave his blessing to the 1215 Magna Carta, knowing to do so would in no way lawfully overturn the grant made to him in the 1213 Charter. The Magna Carta is a worthless document, the same as the Declaration of Independence. How can a charter be made void if parties to the charter will never cease to be born? Yeah, the Pope's Pope's descendants is right. Physical as well as nominational. But also descendants of the king. There will always be one, so how can the charter ever be made void? It was given to that lineage. Next footnote is the King John's concession of England and Ireland to the Pope. I'll just read one line. This does it, folks. King John's concession to the Pope made England a fiefdom to Rome. King John, in 1213, gave England to the Pope. So it doesn't matter that King John signed off on the Magna Carta a couple of years after that. Well, it doesn't matter for two reasons. Number one, it was a document signed under duress, so it's unlawful for that reason. But England was not his to give. He couldn't give any rights to these barons. He pretended to. And thus we have the Magna Carta, a worthless document. Pretense. Same thing as the Declaration of Independence. That's why James Montgomery asked the question, does this sound familiar? All right, and that is... That's it. That is part two, and that finishes chapter three of the online book, The United States is Still a British Colony. Chapter three was entitled, Will the Real Government Please Stand Up? There are links to this, to each chapter, on my site from where you got this podcast. This book, the research, was done by James Montgomery. I'm Gordon Comstock. This has been the Ministry of Truth.